This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. For those of you who are new to the show or people who have been listening on and off, always remember we have a parallel personality. Occupied Territory is also a Facebook page, and everything that I say on this show, later on it's posted online as a podcast in the archives of Occupied Territory on PRN. Everything I say here, any reaction you have to it, and follow-ups that I'll make and contributions of any sort, go to the Occupied Territory Facebook page. We have a steadily climbing number of people who like it, who are friends. But it is our – now, I'm not sure I'm getting this right because I'm so old. Is avatar something that's sort of – you're my expert here. Is an avatar something – somebody that sort of represents you in some other universe? Okay. What represent my avatar on Facebook is the Occupied Territory Facebook page. So go there, and any kind of response to the show, as I said, and anything you want to say, long-running debate on third-party candidates, which I'm going to talk about today, too. In fact, there's an article on there right now that I posted. I get stuff from everybody. I get, you know, from right and left, fundamentalist, communist. There isn't anything that I don't get in terms of PR, and I regularly get stuff from fundamentalist conservatives, one of which I posted on the Occupied Territory Facebook page. It turns out there is another third-party candidate that none of us have heard about. And I posted the information. You want to see this. I posted the information on the Occupied Territory Facebook page. But so that's the place to go. Meanwhile, stay tuned. We'll be right back. Okay, so this is Occupied Territory, and this is Mike Fader. We've been on about a year now. The show is about a year old, and I think we're doing pretty well in terms of trying to represent an alternative viewpoint, not just a standard two-party government working through channels viewpoint. The last few weeks I've been watching probably what is the best documentary on the history of New York City that's ever been made. I don't think anything ever compares to it. I think it's just called New York. You can check it out. It was made in 1999, actually, before the Twin Towers came down. And it's an extraordinary history of New York City from the very first beginnings of it up until, you know, 1999. And it's wonderfully done. Quotes from poets and people who lived at the time, writers, politicians. It's just extraordinary. And last night, I got to the part where it talked about the New York City draft riots of 1863. And I don't know why they don't teach this in school. But in 1863, in the middle of the Civil War, there was a riot in New York City, which is the worst riot that has ever happened in the history of the United States. It's the worst civil insurrection, aside from the Civil War. It's the worst civil insurrection and out-of-control riot that has ever occurred in the history of this country. And it was extraordinary. What happened briefly was, in the midst of the Civil War in 1863, there were already tremendous tensions in New York City between the Irish, who were as poor as it could get, and immigrants just pouring into the country because of the potato famine and the British colonialism in their own country. People were starving to death in the hundreds of thousands, even in the millions. They came over to this country and started at the bottom and basically stayed at the bottom. There was no upward mobility, no public schools for them to go to, nothing. They lived in holes and mud in the ground, slums, beyond anything that people could comprehend now. What's considered poor now would be something they would aspire to in those days. And they were constantly facing off with the black population in the city. And the blacks had been here before the Irish, generally, because they had been here as slaves in the first place. And then when they were freed and people who were born free lived in the city and worked here, the Irish showed up in giant waves. And there was immediate competition at the bottom, you know, for street sweepers, wagon drivers, sweeping horse manure up from the street. I mean, it was, you know, whatever was the crap job, same old stuff as it ever was. These people were fighting over it, right? And the Irish met with the most astounding, violent vitriolic hatred from the, what were called the nativists, the Native Americans. The best movie ever made about this, although it has, what's his name? Leonardo DiCaprio, what's his name? Leonardo, forget his first name. Leonardo DiCaprio, the worst actor in the history of Hollywood, although he's in it. It's one of the best movies ever made. It's one of the best movies ever made because it has other real actors in it, like Daniel Day-Lewis, who is incredible in this movie. But the best thing about it is Scorsese, who made this movie, spent a tremendous amount of money trying to recreate what things were like for the Irish and what the cities were, what the city was like, the difference. Talk about income inequality. I mean, it's horrible now. But that was also at its height in those days, one of its great heights in America in those days, the rich against the poor. And it's an extremely, if you like history and you want to see a decent movie anyhow, this is a wonderful movie. And it ends, the whole thing ends in a giant explosion, which is the New York City draft riots. What happened was that the United States was, you know, fighting the civil, the federal government was fighting the Civil War against the South. And Lee had just crossed over into Virginia, and then into Pennsylvania, and then there was the great Battle of Gettysburg, which was the turning point of the war. However, right around that time, so many Union soldiers had been killed, and there was such a depletion in the ranks that that's when they first came up with a draft. There was a federal draft of troops, and this is what happened. The federal draft of troops hit New York like every other place, and of course, who's going to be drafted? Basically, it's going to be the lower classes, like always. And here's what was different about that draft. And you can imagine if this was happening now, right? There would be no more war. What was happening? What happened then was they issued a draft notice for everybody. You know, had to sign up and had to be had to join if their name was posted. But for $300, if you had $300. You could buy your way out of the draft. So anybody who could come up with $300 could buy their way out of the draft. You just handed the money over to the federal government, the local draft office or wherever, and you were free of the draft. Now, $300 is about $6,000 to $8,000 in today's money. If you had that much money, maybe as much as $10,000, call it $10,000 in today's money. So obviously anybody who is middle class, upper middle class, or upper class could buy their way out of the draft, and they did frequently in great and great numbers. Who was left, who could never buy their way out of the draft, were the poor and the Irish. Now, the Irish already had it in for the blacks in the city and were frequently always sort of violently bumping them out of jobs, beating them up already. And they are the victims themselves, the Irish, of tremendous abuse from what were called Native Americans. And I don't mean Indians. I mean nativists, people who thought that these were the original Tea Party morons in the United States. They were called know-nothings or nativists. And they were frequently attacking the Irish. They wouldn't let. And so, of course, the Irish weren't allowed to hold any jobs except the lowest level. Some of them were allowed to be cops, but they weren't allowed to have any political power at all. Not really any political power. But they were more and more pouring in all the time. But even though they had no political power and they were considered replaceable units to clean up horse manure, naturally, of course, they're certainly qualified to serve in the army and to get killed and to shoot other people in a cause. It's the same old thing as always. So the draft is announced. Within days, the Irish, because of this buyout thing too, they took over the city in one of the most astounding, violent, out of control, murderous mob that ever happened in the United States of America. And there are whole books about the New York City draft riots. And it's worth reading for educational purposes, not just because it's interesting, quote unquote, because it'll tell you a little bit about the way the country works now and always has worked. The rich against the poor, groups, minority groups being played off against each other, who serves in the army, what war is all about, and all of this. So during the course of this riot, several hundred people were killed. And you have to multiply this times, I don't know, something like 8 to 10. So it's like several thousand people were killed or disabled or permanently disfigured. Several thousand people were beaten up brutally and killed. And they don't even know how many people, but they're estimating several thousand because a lot of people, the Irish, invaded houses all over the place. They looted half the city. They broke into rich people's houses, which is fine with me. And they found every black person they could find walking on the street. They broke into a black orphanage, the biggest black orphanage in the country, which was on 43rd Street and 5th Avenue in New York City, which is where, you know, which is like the center of town now. It was a huge building, and it was the Negro orphanage. Kids, right? No parents. And the Irish mob broke into this building and tried. They would have killed everybody in it, but the kids escaped, you know, like minutes before, you know, just minutes before the Irish mob broke in. Burned the whole place down. They found black people in the street. They beat them to death. They shot them. They stabbed them. They cut parts of them off and spread them among the crowd as souvenirs. They hung them. They set fire to them. They must have killed 30, 40, 50 black people that people know about. And threw a whole lot of other people into the East River or into the Hudson River. I mean, this was an insane riot. But what happens here, the reason I'm bringing this up is, and this is the way of history, right? Until then, the Irish had no political power at all. None. And although they had tried, all they had was a few low-level beat cops that they were allowed to patrol their own neighborhoods. Oh, by the way, the end of the riot happened. Their police couldn't handle it. Nobody can handle it. They had to bring back several brigades of soldiers, some of whom were from New York originally, even Irish soldiers, to New York City. And they had gunboats, warships over in the East River and in the East River, basically. They had warships that bombarded the city. And they had Gatling guns on the roofs, and they had to have brigades of soldiers firing directly into crowds and tracking down people and bayoneting and shooting people who wouldn't surrender, you know, and then arresting thousands more. This is how it ended. The army had to actually come back here and put it down because it was out of control. They were burning the whole city down. They were robbing everything. They were beating up people and killing people indiscriminately. It was astounding. But what's interesting, here's what's interesting to me after this. Oh, by the way, I should tell you that last week, we're supposed to have interviewed Sherry Hunkela, who is the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party. We're hoping that she calls in today. She's scheduled to call in today at 11:30. We don't know if she will or not. We hope so. So anyhow, the draft riots happen. It gets put down. But what happened directly after that is what's fascinating to me. Right after that, the city of New York, after having punished people who, you know, whatever, whoever they could catch and arrest people and punish people for whatever crimes they committed, realized that they couldn't treat something like a quarter of the people in the city, because it was by then a huge population of the Irish, maybe, you know, a fifth or a quarter of the people in the city and increasing all the time. They had to give them political power. And right after that, they were appointed to various alderman jobs. Now, all these people were corrupt. You know, I'm not saying it was, you know, a good thing, but it was a good thing for the Irish. They finally got to participate in the American political system, for better or for worse, whatever that was, you know, whoever got the most bribes or bought the most votes. And in those days, they really did that, right out on the street in front of the polling places. Here's $5. Go in and vote. Here's another $5. Go in and vote again. They used to say, vote early and vote often. And they would do it right outside the polling place, right? So, but what happened right after this giant riot where everybody lost control of themselves, where massive felonies and murders were committed, they gave them political power. This was not a civil rights march. This was not Gandhi. This was not violent, nonviolent demonstrations. I'm not saying one thing or another here. I'm just saying that if you look at the vast sweep of history in this country and in other countries, you see that more often than not, when things get so out of control and people are so oppressed by an elitist, oppressive upper class, as they are now in this country, when that happens, you're very likely to get anything from an insurrection to an out-and-out sustained revolution until things are changed. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people will be killed thrown out of their houses and driven away as refugees. And then, sometimes, very often, they will get political power, or they will take over political power, become just as dictatorial and brutal themselves, which is sort of the history of humanity. But still, little by little by little, if you look at the last couple of hundred years, in most places in the world, despite whatever violent cataclysm happened, little by little by little, there has been an increase in the general level of equality and democracy. But it never happens unless somebody puts tremendous pressure, usually almost always illegal pressure, on the people that own and run everything. And that's why this show is here. It's called Occupied Territory, originally established about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, actually, to honor and to celebrate and to try to, you know, encourage the Occupy movement. Because we are all aware, anybody who's listening to me and who listens regularly is aware of the fact that voting doesn't work anymore. it doesn't work anymore. You may get the lesser of two evils in there, but you have a steady march of corporate fascist control over the country, basically military security, corporate control over the country. People are getting richer and richer, and most people are getting poorer and poorer, the vast majority, the 99%. This has happened under every administration since World War II. Let's just use that as a starting point. It was always the American way, but it's happened more and often all the time. Now, under, you know, it has happened under Carter, it happened under Reagan, it happened under Clinton. It doesn't make any difference. If you get a Democratic administration, you will get on social issues like abortion, on gay marriage, on 100 other things like that. You know, women getting better pay, getting appointed to federal jobs at a higher level. You get more of that from a Democratic administration. So that's a good thing, right? And that's one thing to recommend Obama about. I mean, look at the Supreme Court. Look at, you know, equal pay for equal work for women, abortion stuff. Look at the Republicans versus the Democrats. But always in a more structural, basic way, in an economic way, which affects all of our lives all the time. It gets worse all the time. And it doesn't matter who's in power. And what we see now in this country is an income inequality, which is almost beyond description. It's so staggering that it, in a way it equals or surpasses the worst of income inequality in other times. However, there are two major differences. One major difference is that the level of poverty, the actual daily life of a poverty-stricken person in this country, and there are tens of millions of people at the level of poverty, food stamps, living in substandard conditions, not having health care, whatever, you name it, and just sheer poverty, hardly able to even buy food from week to week or pay rent. The costs of everything go up, but, wages don't go up. But the mass of people who live in poverty now truly don't live in the kind of, poverty that existed in the 1860s, during the draft riot, in the 1890s, even in the 1930s. They don't live in that kind of poverty. There aren't millions of people dying of malnutrition and wandering the streets. There aren't millions of people. And when it was happening back then, it's a much higher percentage by inflation. Now it would be, tens of millions of people who literally didn't have enough to eat, who were dying in the streets, like Calcutta, living eight to a room in tenements. And that happens in this country, especially among migrant workers, especially among Latino migrant workers and some on some Indian reservations and various other places. But the poverty, the most poverty-stricken person in this country sometimes manages to get a hold, sometimes, of a cell phone. Some people will have some kind of television. There are food stamps. There are safety nets even, right? There's a sort of minimum level of existence. There are people who are homeless, but nothing like what it was in the 30s or the 1890s or the 1860s, that kind of thing, when there were almost revolutions in this country, giant riots and revolutions. And you can almost measure it by a mathematical formula. The true direness of the poverty suffered by the large number of people at certain times in this country resulted in that level of response. So now what we've got is tens of millions of people who are just living staggeringly miserable lives. They live on food stamps. They live on charity. They're moving back into their parents' basements. Nobody can pay their bills. The cost of everything goes up. Everything is bad. And yet you don't see giant riots in the street. You don't see it. And you'll have to just speculate as to why. One of the reasons I think is, from studying a lot of American history, is that the level of the widespread level and the direness of the poverty does not equal what it once did. It does not equal what it once did. Also, interestingly enough, the lesser of two evil governments, whichever party is in, usually that would be referring to Democrats for somebody who's from my part of the spectrum, the lesser of two evils will give you just enough. You know, they'll throw you enough breadcrumbs so that you don't literally starve, so that you don't go and literally try to peck their eyes out. They give you just enough. And back in the day, when people didn't have a safety net and couldn't care less if people died, and they figured this, it was totally Calvinist. You could call it fundamentalist now, or Ayn Randist. Back in the day, back before the 30s, if you were poor, God meant you to be that way. If you were starving to death, tough shit. That's it. If you were broke and you couldn't find anything, you couldn't find any work, well, that's the way the Lord wanted it, And there are people who talk that way now. You see them on the campaign. Generally, most Republicans immediately issue a press release disavowing them. What about this? Oh, all right. So let me stick to something for a change, right? Okay. So it's not just the number of people who are officially in poverty, but it's the actual direness of the poverty. It's just not as bad as it once was. You know, as bad as it is, there are safety nets. There are emergency rooms. There was nothing back then. You got sick, you died. You know, you were hungry, you died. You know, you had no place to live, you died. That's the way it was. And that was fine with the mass of American people until there were riots, until there was great violence all the way through from the 1860s, even before that, through the 1880s, 1890s. Just study history. You'll see every 10, 15 years, giant threats and riots and massive strikes and walkouts that crippled whole industries. We don't see that now. Why is that? Because people have a little bit more now, and they have some safety nets that they didn't ever have before. And that's just enough sometimes to keep them from being violent. What else do we have? Guess what else we have? We have the widespread use of addictive stuff to keep people somatized. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, everybody's taken a drug called Soma, which is basically a prefiguration of Prozac and everything else. We've got everybody drugged in this country. Kids are drugged in school. Everybody's taking drugs. There must be 50 million prescriptions written every 3 months in this country for something to keep you from blowing off, to keep you going off the handle and blowing your top and losing it, right? Keep everybody under control. Illegal drugs, legal drugs, and technology and television, anything that keeps people amused. The Romans knew about this, but we've really got it down here. The Romans knew about it. The Nazis knew about it. But nobody has ever done it like the Americans. I mean, and I'm not saying it's all deliberate or it's part of some giant conspiracy, but it's fine with the people who rule us and who own everything and take more and more of what we have all the time. The trouble is that sometimes people get carried away. And this is what history shows, too, that in places sometimes where the elite gets so rich and everybody else is so poor, and they manage to build up, you know, private security armies, and the army is personally working for them anyhow. And this is more like this in this country all the time. Gated communities, fire departments, private police forces. The army itself going to be drafted soon to patrol the streets of the country because there's a law that the president just signed, Mr. Lesser of Two Evils, just signed, that allows anybody to be denominated a terrorist by him or somebody who he has appointed. Anybody. That includes you who are listening now or me. If they decide you're a terrorist, if you're aiding and abetting a terrorist, if you say good morning, how you doing to a terrorist, you're a goddamn terrorist. And they can lock you up and throw away the key, and there's no habeas corpus for you. It's a law now. It's a law now. And this is what happens. I'm just pointing out that at many times in our history, it took massive violence. And, of course, in the 60s, it didn't happen that way. The anti-war movement had its violence. But essentially, nonviolence during the 60s got people basic civil rights. It stopped the war. It did other things, too. Massive protest strikes and nonviolence, which were illegal 95% of the time. Illegal, and they were beaten. People were beaten by the cops. Dogs were set on people. People were arrested. But they didn't murder people in the thousands. You know, it wasn't like the French Revolution. But sooner or later, if people keep getting away with this, and they do all the time now, and we let them because we're passive, because we're drugged out by TV and video games and drugs and whatever else that's addictive in this society. If we let them get away with it, they will take everything. And they don't have any control over themselves. The rich are all out of control psychopaths. They will get themselves as much as they can to the point where everybody in the country is on the point of revolution. They don't care. They don't care until they have a gun in their face, until they see a member of their family bludgeoned to death in front of them. They don't get it. This is sometimes what you have to do to these people. I'm not encouraging this. I'm not encouraging violence or breaking the law. I'm just saying this is what history has shown us. And I think right now, we're in a place in this country, we're having this vast contest, you know, they call it the race for the president, right? This contest for who's going to be the president. Essentially, you're choosing between two corporate candidates who are utterly locked in, whether they even like it or not, to the military and to corporations in this country. They are owned and controlled by the rich. And it doesn't matter. The worst something like Obama will say, the most extreme thing this guy will say is, And he'll look out at the camera with his little pleasant smile on his face. He says, and the wealthy should pay just, wealthy folks should pay a little bit more. Wealthy folks should pay just a little more. A little more. Let me tell you, I guess I talk about equality and democracy all the time. If I was in charge of this country, anybody who had over $1 million would lose every last penny of everything over $1 million they had. Michael Bloomberg, the Duke of New York, has $27 billion. I would take all his houses away, every last bit of his money, and leave him $1 million and tell him to go to work. That's a lot of money, $27 billion straight into the New York State and New York City economy. Would we leave almost everything that ails New York City and the state of New York? Fix highways, feed people, build buildings, you name it, everything, medical care. The Waltons, who pay people $8 an hour to stand up all day long on the floor of their stores. They all live on food stamps. They don't have $8 an hour. No one can live on $8 an hour in the United States of America, but that's what they pay them. So they have a million employees, a million and a half employees that they pay $8 an hour, maybe $10 an hour if they've been there a couple of years. They don't have the best health insurance or none at all. They hardly ever get breaks. They're treated like crap, like animals. And there's five members of the Walton family that have at least $20 or $30 billion each. I would take every last penny away from these people, put on a little blue uniform, and make them stand up in their stores all day long at the cashier's desk. So, you see, I'm not so democratic after all. I mean, and if we could take all these rich people's money away, there's a guy named Larry Ellison, who's the head of Oracle, recently bought an island off the coast of Hawaii, off the main coast of Hawaii, of the Hawaiian Islands. He bought his own private island for $100 million. He's got eight homes all over the world. Bloomberg has six mansions and homes all over the world. John McCain, who ran for president, has so many houses he didn't remember how many he had. Romney has three mansions, and he's going to improve on them. He's going to go to car elevators so his cars don't get tired walking up the steps. I guess they need an elevator. So I would take all of their money away, and believe me, that would it would solve everything. I'm not talking about redistribution. That's a polite word for what I'm talking about, because it's gone too far. And if it keeps going further, nonviolence is not going to do it. Nonviolence will not do it. You know what I mean? The worst thing that could happen in this country that would cause an instant overwhelming revolution and violence, blood would flow in the streets like nobody has ever seen, if all of a sudden all satellite communication went out. If people couldn't use their cell phones or use their apps, if they couldn't watch their satellite TV, if they couldn't even get their satellite radio or whatever it was, if that went out and then cable service went down, and you understand, you could still pay your, you could still go to work, you could buy food, right? There would be food. But if people couldn't be amused and hypnotized and drugged by everything that comes over these cables and over a satellite, then these people would really have to watch out for their lives. People would hit the streets then. I don't know what that says about America. Meanwhile, we're supposed to have, I mentioned earlier that Sherry Hunkelow, who's the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, was supposed to be here last week. We've rearranged for her to be on this week, hopefully to call in around 11:30, and we'll talk to her. If you listen to my Sirius program, or if you can get Sirius XM Radio, I'm going to have Jill Stein on this coming Saturday, and a bunch of other candidates on, and other people too, like Bob Edgar, who's the head of Common Cause, is going to talk about in detail voter suppression and voter theft, 99% of which comes from the Republicans. Why is that? Why is it only Republicans who have to steal votes and frighten people and terrorize people into not being able to vote? Well, I guess the answer might be obvious. They wouldn't win otherwise. And that's what's going to happen in this election. The election is, what, less than 2 weeks away? What's going to happen? What you should watch out for? Obama will have the women's votes. He'll have the Latino votes. He may be ahead in this poll and that poll. In the end, however much he's ahead has to be that much more than the Republicans are going to steal from him. The Republicans are intimately connected to and own 90% of the voting machines in this country. They are staunch Republican advocates and supporters, Diebold and a few other companies. And one of the companies, the company in Ohio that supplies the voting machines and controls the voting machines, which are very easy to hack, by the way, if you know the codes and the company knows them, utterly controlled by Republican donors and Republican backers, utterly controlled. And everybody who's paid any attention to this knows that in Ohio, the last election was literally stolen from Kerry because of what happened in Ohio. The Secretary of State was a criminal named Ken Blackwell, And he counted the votes. He's a Republican. The night before the election in Ohio, which is apparently the key state, Dick Cheney flew the night before the election to visit with the Secretary of State of Ohio, probably just to say, hi, how you doing, right? What do you think? And the next day, in counties and in districts where everybody understood Kerry to be way ahead by any kind of poll you could use, Bush came out 4, 5, 6 percentage points ahead in the actual voting. What an amazing thing. And it was all electronic voting. So watch for that. This is what you watch for at the very end, at the summary of all the stuff that's going on, this vote, the women's vote, the Latino vote, the black vote, the rich, the white, the hating Obama of racism vote. All of this all counts for something. What's really going to count is, will he have enough votes in key states to outpace the number of votes that are literally stolen from the Democratic Party and from the president? It'd be interesting to see, right? And if, in fact, it comes out that way and there's serious suspicion by anybody that there's going to be that there was criminality involved, there already is. Will he be like Gore? Will he hold things up and will he actually go further than Gore and just ask for an injunction to have the election done all over again or to just stop the process? I don't know how that would work exactly. Do we have our guest on? Okay, let's go to a slight break here and then we'll be back. We do have our guest on the line. They paid paradise and put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't we all seem to go, but you don't know what you got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Okay, we're back. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Remember what I told you before? Don't forget, Occupied Territory on Facebook, the Facebook page Occupied Territory, where you can check out these shows on podcasts and respond to them and post your own comments. We have with us Sherry Hunkela, who is the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party. Hiya. Is she there? Oh, the phone call was just lost. Okay. Sherry Hunkela is... she's got an interesting background. She was born in Minneapolis and grew up in utter poverty and had dealt with all kinds of really serious, bad family situations. A lot of it had to do with her background. And she later on became an activist, an organizer, especially about abandoned, homes that were abandoned and foreclosure and mortgages and poor families and housing. And she has been, for the last 25 years, a leading advocate for poor and homeless in America. And she co-founded the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. And she's organized tens of thousands of people around these issues, holding marches, demonstrations, et cetera. And has a very interesting background in many other ways, too. So do we have you here, finally?
Yes, I'm here and happy to be here today.
Okay, and so it's coming down to the wire here. Now, just briefly, let's go over the thing that we might have gone over last week, is that you and Jill showed up at the debate, the presidential debate, right? And
yes.
And wound up, and you know, I'm losing track of these debates because they're all blending into the same corporate squabble. But at one of the last debates, and the two of you not being admitted, as you should have been, to the debate, that is to say, Jill, anyhow, on the stage, the two of you attempted to assert your rights under the law and got arrested, correct?
Yes. Dr. Jill Stein and I showed up at the Commission on Presidential Debates debate. And as we arrived, we asked to speak to somebody from the CPD. We thought at least they'd send somebody out, whether it was some bureaucrat or whoever, but instead we were escorted by a number of officers and Secret Service, and then we were taken to a secret location and placed in a warehouse and handcuffed with both hands together sideways for over 8 hours.
Really? No kidding. And did no call to the lawyer?
No, I was not asked to call anybody. We finally had you know, Alex, who just happens to be a friend, and my handler, but he also happens to be a lawyer, was able to find out where we were at. And then he just, you know, called and was able to talk to Jill for a couple minutes. No, we weren't given any opportunity to call any lawyer or do anything like that. So
I wanted to get people to understand exactly what's going on here. The Commission on Presidential Debates, somewhere in the late 80s, took over these presidential debates from the League of Women Voters. And they sort of basically became a kind of a duopoly, the Democratic and Republican Party, and they dictate all the rules. However, and you can point this out, I want you to point this out for me, the rules are to be able to get up and to be in the debates. What are the rules?
Well, basically the entire process is controlled by the Democrats and the Republicans, and you know, the Commission on Presidential Debates is actually 10 corporations. So it's basically, you know, corporate America all around that's making a decision about, you know, who gets into the debates, including both Romney and Obama's camp, even down to the level that they determine what questions they're not going to ask each other. And those kinds of things. So it basically is a great deal of theater on very important issues for the American public.
But wait, when you say corporations, do you mean actual financial corporations?
Yes, actual.
Like
U.S. Airways and others. I will say that there was three corporations that did pull out from the CPD from sponsoring the debate only because of the great work of about four national organizations that really began to put pressure on the Commission on Presidential Debates to act in a fair manner.
Let me ask you this. I don't really understand this, and maybe you could explain it. The two candidates for president, you know, the two major, I should say, candidates for president, the two major parties are running. They're going to stand up on a stage. There's only two chairs. It's a stage. It's not a big production. It's not a Hollywood production. Two chairs, a stage. They sit and talk to each other, and it's broadcast over various networks. Why does it need to be sponsored by anybody? I mean, why isn't it paid for with taxpayer money in a simple way?
Yeah, because that would be far too dangerous. I mean, the American people would be able to hear a variety of ideas, and they would be able to make decisions on their own, particularly when it comes to candidates like Dr. Jill Stein, when 85% of the population is eligible to vote for her. They don't really want to give her a platform like that. No, platforms are only given to people that have billions of dollars in their campaigns.
Now she qualified, your ticket qualified for federal matching campaign funds, right?
That's correct. And we're also on, you know, 38 ballots across the country, and a great deal of work went into them.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you an example, in Pennsylvania, 2,000 signatures for Democrats, 2,000 signatures for Republicans. And we had to get over 20,000 signatures. We actually ended up walking away with 35,000 signatures because Pennsylvania has always challenged, signatures and the ballot process.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just multiply that towards, you know, the other 37 states in the country.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of work for political parties that don't have financial resources.
So there's that they're doing. I mean, but basically you qualify according to the number of ballots you're on. You qualify according to the number of estimated votes that you're going to get. You qualify for federal matching campaign funds. But the other thing that we're missing, of course, when Jill and you are not in these debates, are issues that the overwhelming majority of the country is concerned about, but you will never hear mention of the debates. And you didn't hear mention of the debates, right?
That's right. I mean, you certainly didn't hear anything about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't hear anything about mass incarceration. You didn't hear anything about the school-to-prison pipeline.
And,
you didn't hear anything about fracking.
Or legalizing marijuana. You didn't hear about
that. Or legalizing marijuana or bringing the military home. You heard two corporate candidates talking about who can tighten their belt the tightest.
Our belts, not their belts.
tighten our belt. Right. And, you know, balance the budget on the backs of the American people when there's not a scarcity issue in this country. And then you also heard them talking about, you know, who can be meaner and, clap down on people and police and supposedly create democracies in other parts of the world when we really need to be taking a different approach to foreign policy.
We're getting such a terrible signal. I think we might have to cut this off. It's almost unintelligible. Are you moving around?
I'm just arrived from the airport.
Okay.
So,
yeah. It's a hard signal. So, and it's really hard for the listeners to hear. But I guess we'll just.
I understand. Yeah,
no. One other question. There's one or two other questions I want to ask. So, a lot of people these days, Noam Chomsky and Daniel Ellsberg, two people who I admire a lot, among other people who I admire, have come out and said that they are voting for you and Jill. But they don't live in swing states, and they actually advise people, everybody, to vote for you and Jill, except if you live in a swing state. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I mean, I think that we're absolutely thrilled to have the endorsement of Noam Chomsky, and there's actually other progressives that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
But for the majority of the American people that haven't been surviving, whether it's under a Republican or Democratic Party administration, we just want to encourage folks to continue to vote courage, because we're just going to see the same old drama under, you know, Obama or Mitt Romney. And so if people want to call for an end to climate change, if they want to call an end to homelessness, to stopping wars for oil, then today is the day to begin to go forward and build something new,
mm-hmm.
and to vote courage on Election Day, and that's to vote for Dr. Jill Stein and Sherry Honkola.
All right. I can see you're on your way, and I know you've got a million things to do because it's only like, what, I don't know, several days until this corporate election. So there's one more debate, right, that's available for people to see, an actual debate between third-party candidates. Isn't there one left? I think there is.
Yes, and people can get the information on the jillstein.org website.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to encourage folks to, you know, really utilize social media and get that information around.
Okay, and I guess if they want to contribute, they can do that too.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Whatever attention we can get in these last 12 days, we need the American people's help, and that means both in getting the word out, mm-hmm. and digging deep in their pockets and making a financial contribution.
Okay, thanks for calling.
So much for having me on your show.
Okay, Sherry, thanks a lot. I'm going to talk to Jill on Saturday.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. It sounded like she was talking from underwater. There's a couple more questions I would ask, but the signal is too hard. But, the other night I had a guy on my Sirius show. I should add before I move on from this, I watch MSNBC here and there. I will watch MSNBC because I can't watch any other, you know, regular TV station, or certainly not Fox or whatever. But I watch MSNBC, and they're basically cheerleaders for the Democratic Party, any Democratic candidate, no matter who it is, and certainly for the president. And you'll never hear one word out of their mouths, hardly ever one word out of any of their mouths about, you know, the stuff, the NDAA, the elimination of habeas corpus for anybody who's accused of terrorism in this country, and the vaguest possible law, which a federal judge, by the way, in New York, in the Second Circuit in New York, finally determined was just too vague and too onerous and unconstitutional. So it's being appealed by the government. But you'll never, like Sherry just said, you'll never hear any discussion, and you didn't hear any discussion in a debate, nor will you hear it in speeches or questions from any media people. They'll show up on whatever it is, Good Morning America, The View, Housewives of Orange County, wherever the candidates show up, you know, to tell everybody how they feel about what they allege they feel. But you'll never hear anybody actually put a question to them. Stephanopoulos, whoever runs these shows, you know, David, what's his name? Gregory, I don't know, on NBC. You'll never hear any of them actually say directly to these candidates, why did you sign a bill that effectively eliminates habeas corpus for American citizens if your administration thinks they're terrorists? How could you do a thing like that? You'll never hear him say that. What's wrong with legalizing marijuana? Studies have shown, et cetera. What about climate change? Why didn't you bring it up? You understand that during the presidential debates, as Sherry was talking, was mentioning, the two parties get together, and there are the main sponsor of the presidential debates was Anheuser-Busch. These companies, there shouldn't be any sponsors to the presidential debates. As soon as that happens, you're right out of it. I mean the average American citizen has nothing to do with it. They get together and they decide along with the moderator what questions are going to be asked. Now, the moderator gets on there, Schieffer, whoever the hell it is, right? Whoever mainstream person that they pick who's safe will get on there and they will never, never bring up these really hard questions to ask these people. They're all in it together. A guy like Bob Schieffer or any of the moderators of this debate make anywhere from $1 million to $10 million a year, whatever it is they get paid for doing whatever nonsense they put over the TV. Now, they get this money, right? And they make their living off whoever gets elected president. They couldn't be the White House correspondent. They couldn't be the anchor of a place if they asked one single hard question. So they don't. They don't ask these questions. And so you're not really seeing a real debate in a real democracy for president. Now, just think of it. Think of single payer. Did you hear one word about that in the debate? No, you didn't. Think of the drone wars and the killings of civilians. The president's kill list. You didn't hear anything about that. And you name it, on and on and on. You don't hear a damn thing about it. You hear nothing about it at all. Everything is safe. Everything is sanitized. And you get to choose between two people, as Maureen Dowd put it the other day, two guys mud wrestling on the head of a pin. Mud wrestling on the head of a pin. You hear two guys in suits arguing with each other who's going to be the biggest macho man, who's going to make America number one the fastest, who's going to keep America number one the best. No question like, sir or a governor or Mr. President, why do we need to be number one? Isn't that what got us in trouble in the first place? Isn't that kind of xenophobic? Isn't that kind of arrogant to assume that we're and they say it straight out, these two guys, we are the best country in the world. We are a better country than other countries. Straight out. I don't know what anybody else thinks about that. Can you imagine what the rest of the world thinks when they hear this? The arrogance, the astounding arrogance. But no one will put a question to them. So meanwhile, I'm listening to MSNBC last night, and I was sort of off and on watching the baseball game, which I like watching. And I check in, and they got a guy on, Lawrence O'Donnell, who's on at 10 o'clock. Now, the audience drops way off a cliff after Rachel Maddow. She's on from 9 to 10. The audience drops off a cliff demographic and numbers-wise. And you get maybe, I don't know, 100 to 200,000 people left watching Lawrence O'Donnell, who's a terrific broadcaster. Extremely intelligent, a man of obvious integrity, but a rah-rah guy for the Democrats. Meanwhile, he gets on last night at around 10:45, a quarter to 11, when he probably has only 50,000 listeners left because half of them went off to the ball game anyhow, and says the most extraordinary thing I've ever heard on MSNBC. I've never heard any one of these people on there for like years mention anything like that. He gets on and for 10 minutes showed you portions of the third party debate that occurred the other night. Larry King, poor old Larry King, has a TV show which is shown over C-SPAN sometimes. It's his own production company or whatever. And he had Virgil Good from the Constitution Party. He had Gary Johnson from the Libertarian Party, and I'm going to interview him on Sirius in a couple of weeks. And he had Jill Stein on, and he had Rocky Anderson from the Justice Party. He had four candidates up there all mentioning all these issues that concern all of us. In a real way, saying real things, who all should have been, at least one or two of them anyhow, up on the debate stage, the Libertarian candidate, let's say, and the Green Party candidate, they should have been on the debate stage and would have kept those two corporate suits far more honest and would have made them have to come clean about what they're doing in the real world. And so Lawrence O'Donnell is on there. He actually showed long clips from these debates, and he said, you didn't hear this on any major media or major network, and he was clearly including his own. So good for him. Some people have some courage, right? And he was saying, furthermore, that he himself has voted since, I don't know when it was, like 1972, and he has only voted once for a Democratic candidate. He voted all the other times for a third-party candidate. And he was very clear about it. He said, if you want somebody who represents your real feelings about the way the country should be, real issues, not just this corporate, you know, bullshit up there about who's going to really be, you know, ceding the country to the corporations. If you really want to hear somebody, if you want to vote for somebody who actually represents what real people need and want, then vote for one of these third party candidates. I'm sure he'll be voting for, you know, for Jill Stein. And he says he has never done this. But then he added, which is something that I mentioned before, Noam Chomsky, same thing that Noam Chomsky and Daniel Ellsberg said. And I guess I've sort of come out and supported this point of view against my own, you know, better conscience. But I've supported it anyhow. He said, however, I'm voting for a third party candidate, as I am, by the way. I'm voting for Jill Stein. You can do it if you live in a state where it's not an utter toss-up. Is there a difference between the two candidates? Yeah. Look at the Supreme Court. Look at equal rights for women. Look at the whole treatment of women, contraception and abortion rights. Look at all that. That's enough right there. The fact that the president is a corporate murderer on a huge scale and getting worse all the time, that he inflates the Homeland Security Gestapo budget, that he has no interest in helping anybody unless somebody puts direct pressure on him. He'll never do the right thing voluntarily. This guy is a corporate loser like everybody else, but he is actually better than the other guy. And I'm torn, finally, you know, we're almost at the end of the program here. I'm torn between two things. And this goes all the way back to what I started talking about, the draft riots and the idea that sometimes actual violent revolution is what is needed to change the society or what has been needed. Let me put it that way. I'm not advocating it straight out. Sometimes I think to myself, you know what? Vote the party of your conscience. Vote for Jill Stein. Vote for the Libertarian candidate, whoever you want. Vote for Jill Stein. If we all voted for Jill, if there were 3 million votes for her and some in swing states and Obama lost because of that, maybe finally we would get a lot quicker to the point where the country would wake up from its drug and TV and video game induced torpor and actually take to the streets and take the government back from the people who are running it and owning the country. If, what I'm saying is very clear, if Romney got elected because you voted your conscience, even in a swing state, and voted for a third-party candidate, if Romney and Ryan got elected, these two Taliban, Christian Taliban types, if they got elected with all the money and all the violence and all the warmongering and all the corporate insanity that is directly behind them, not indirectly like with Obama, if they got elected and within a year or two, because of a Supreme Court appointment or because of various laws, abortion became, imagine this, illegal in every state in the union, just like it was a long time ago, not so long ago. Abortion was illegal, becomes a federal law, go to federal prison. If you personally attempt to have an abortion for any reason whatsoever, you know, apparently Mr. Romney supports this candidate, though he tried to distance himself, but that's nonsense. He supports his candidate in Indiana, the latest and greatest right-wing lunatic who said that if a woman gets raped, that's too bad. He feels a little bit bad about that. However, there should be no abortion because it's God's will that this child should be born. And then you got to ask yourself, if this guy gets elected in Indiana, if this guy gets elected in Indiana, what are we to think about, A, the people in Indiana who vote, and B, the women in Indiana who vote? If they don't vote 99% to 1 against this guy, then I don't know what the country is, what hope there is for this country. It's not just the candidates, it's the voters. Who votes for people like this? Who would vote for Paul Ryan and Romney? People vote for him. They're saying that lower class white men or lower middle class white men, workers, are going to vote overwhelmingly for Romney. They are the very people who will get screwed by Romney and Ryan, and yet they will vote anyhow. One of the main reasons, if not the main reason, is because the guy right now in office that they don't want is black. It's racial hatred, pure and simple. That's why they're voting against this guy, even against their own interests. Well, anyhow, but sometimes I think, maybe, you know, vote your conscience, vote for Jill Stein, That's the difference. The Republicans steal votes. Obama gets defeated. Romney and Ryan are elected. They go to town, institute a total fascist, corporate, anti-female, elitist monarchy. And then maybe people will finally change the government. Because if we vote for Obama and he gets in and he's going to take us all for granted like he usually does, same corporations, same as it ever was, same crap, the drilling, the treatment of women everywhere by states. Well, that's the way it's going to be. We're going to get what we vote for. All right. We'll be back next week.